world and everything in it is made possible by listeners like us. My name is Pam Dunlap. My husband Doug and I live on beautiful Beaver Lake in Garfield, Arkansas, population 502. We find listening to The World and Everything in It is an educational and entertaining way to pass the time on our 45-minute drives into town. I hope you enjoy today's program.
Good morning. Aid to Ukraine is pouring in from the U.S. and its allies. We'll hear the details.
That's ahead on Washington Wednesday. Also today, World Tour, plus the Walk of a Christian.
God told Abraham, walk the land, the length, the width. But then later he said, walk before me and be perfect. So you have a physical walk and you have a spiritual walk.
And world commentator Janie B. Chaney on what you bring to the church.
It's Wednesday, March 16th. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Good morning.
Time now for the news. Here's Kent Covington.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky will address the U.S. Congress today. His live-streamed virtual address into the U.S. Capitol will be among his most important, as he hopes for more backing from Western allies. Zelensky is heard here through an interpreter on Tuesday, making an appeal to Canadian leaders that he is likely to echo today.
Close the airspace. Please stop the bombing. How many more cruise missiles have to fall on our cities until you make this happen?
The White House and Western allies remain opposed to enforcing a no-fly zone over Ukraine, which they say could greatly escalate the war with Russia. Zelensky has used his public campaign to help ensure a global spotlight and to drum up support from Western allies. Last week, speaking to the British House of Commons, he invoked Winston Churchill and Hamlet as he asked whether Ukraine is to be or not to be. Zelensky will address the U.S. Congress at 9 a.m. Eastern Time this morning. The White House says President Biden will travel to Europe next week for face-to-face talks with allies. Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters.
The president will travel to Brussels, Belgium later this month, where he will join an extraordinary NATO summit on March 24th to discuss ongoing deterrence and defense efforts in response to Russia's unprovoked and unjustified attack on Ukraine.
He will also attend a scheduled European Council summit to discuss humanitarian efforts and further sanctions against Russia. Following Tuesday's announcement, President Biden signed a bill that will provide nearly $14 billion in additional aid to Ukraine. That aid is part of a $1.5 trillion government spending measure.
We're moving urgently to further augment the support to the brave people of Ukraine as they defend their country.
The trip follows Vice President Kamala Harris's visit to the eastern flank NATO countries of Poland and Romania last week to discuss the growing refugee crisis. On Tuesday, the prime ministers of Poland, Czech Republic, and Slovenia traveled to the Ukrainian capital of Kyiv to meet with President Zelensky. The three leaders ignored security concerns and went ahead with the hours-long train trip despite the risks of traveling within a war zone. Zelensky expressed gratitude for their visit, calling it a powerful testimony of support. The meeting came as Russian forces continued to bombard the area. The mayor of Kyiv, Vitaly Klitschko, said Tuesday that the Russians shelled another residential building.
Today, another apartment building. We don't know exactly the numbers of people injured.
A top Ukrainian negotiator says talks with Russia will continue today. An advisor to President Zelensky described the talks so far as very difficult and vicious, but he suggested possible room for compromise as Russians continue to take heavy losses. A Fox News reporter was killed Tuesday while covering the war in Ukraine. World's Kristen Flavin has more.
55-year-old Pierre Zekhshevska was filming with his team in a town just outside of Kyiv when Russian fire struck their vehicle. Fox CEO Suzanne Scott announced Tuesday that Zekhshevska died in the conflict, and fellow journalist Benjamin Hall is hospitalized with injuries. Zekhshevska was a London-based reporter who had covered wars in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Syria. Ukrainian journalist Oleksandra Kuvshinova was with the Fox team and was also killed in the same attack. Zekhshevska is the second foreign journalist to die in the war zone this week. Freelance documentary filmmaker Brent Renaud was also killed when Russian troops fired on his car near Kyiv. Reporting for World, I'm Kristen Flavin.
Wholesale inflation in the United States shot up 10% last month from a year earlier as prices continue to surge. The Labor Department said its producer price index rose 0.8% from January. That's the index that tracks inflation before it hits consumers in the wallet. Wholesale energy prices were up nearly 34% over the past year, and food prices up almost 14%. But the report did not reflect changes after February 15th. That means that the numbers do not reflect the spike in energy prices after Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Last week, the government reported that consumer prices saw the sharpest one-year spike since 1982. With COVID-19 cases on the rise in China, authorities on Tuesday tightened lockdown measures at ports, raising the risk of a global trade disruption. World's Josh Schumacher has that story.
The Chinese government continues to enforce a zero-tolerance strategy to prevent large outbreaks. Stock prices in China sank for a second day following the shutdown this week of a tech and finance hub near Hong Kong and an auto center in the northeast. Analysts say for now, smartphone makers and other industries can use factories and suppliers in other parts of China. But a bigger threat looms if business is disrupted at ports in Shenzhen, Shanghai, or Ningbo. Those ports link Chinese factories that assemble most of the world's smartphones and computers and many other goods and components. A one-month slowdown at a Shenzhen port last year caused a backlog of thousands of shipping containers, sending shockwaves through global supply chains. Reporting for World, I'm Josh Schumacher.
And I'm Kent Covington. Straight ahead, a snapshot of Washington's aid to Ukraine, plus the walk of a Christian. This is The World and Everything in It.
It's Wednesday, the 16th of March, 2022. So glad to have you along for today's edition of The World and Everything in It. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichert.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Time now for Washington Wednesday. First up, U.S. aid to Ukraine. Congress last week approved almost $14 billion for military and humanitarian aid for that country. Most lawmakers on both sides of the aisle fully support backing Ukraine against the invading Russian military. In fact, the House approved almost $4 billion more than what President Biden requested. The flow of Western equipment and supplies is a lifeline for the Ukrainian army and for the millions of civilians who have had to flee their homes.
Joining us now on the extent of aid Washington and its allies are providing is Bradley Bowman. He's served as a top national security advisor to members of the U.S. Senate. Bradley, good morning.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. Well, let's start with military aid to Ukraine. Just in terms of weapons and raw materials, what have we provided and what are we providing right now?
Yeah, the U.S. government has provided over $1.2 billion in the last year or so to Ukraine, with a $350 million tranche about a week ago, almost all of which has already arrived, and then a new $200 million tranche just in the last few days. And in terms of weapons, it's been a variety of things, small arms, ammunition, but the two big game changers by far are the Javelin anti-tank missiles. These are shoulder-launched missiles designed to destroy armored personnel carriers and tanks, which have been incredibly effective against Russian equipment. And then also what are called man pads or stingers. These are shoulder-launched missiles that can shoot down helicopters and fixed-wing aircraft flying below roughly 10,000 feet. So those two weapons in particular have been incredibly effective on the battlefield and have deprived Russia of some of the advantages that many predicted that they would have.
And then what about intelligence, logistics, things like that?
Yes. So we have provided intelligence to the Ukrainians, but we have not provided everything we could provide. And this has been, as I've tried to call balls and strikes, this has been one area where I've leveled some constructive criticism at the administration. You know, there's general intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance. Hey, here's generally what the Russians are up to. And then there's a whole other kind of intelligence, what I would call targeting intelligence, basically helping the Ukrainians have information they need to employ these weapons to actually target invading Russian forces. And according to my research and sources as of last week, unless it's changed since then, which I don't believe it has, there is some targeting intelligence we could be providing the Ukrainians that we are not.
We talked on yesterday's program about a no-fly zone and why the United States is very reluctant to do that. But aside from that, is there anything Ukraine is asking us for that we are not providing?
It's a great question. If I may, just very quickly on the no-fly zone, you know, from the beginning, I've argued that, you know, we need to be worried more about helping beleaguered democracies and less about provoking authoritarian bullies like Putin. And so you'd think that kind of belief, which I've held for many years and advised senators as such, you know, after the 2014 Crimea invasion, would lead me to be a strong advocate for a no-fly zone. But I would just quickly add, if I may, for your listeners, that you know, to enforce a no-fly zone, you have to be prepared to shoot down Russian military aircraft. And in so doing, you would put the U.S. and Russia in direct combat, something that we avoided for four decades during the Cold War. And by the way, you hear a lot of people talking about closing the skies. This is a term you'll hear a lot of Ukrainians pleading, and my heart is certainly with them. But a no-fly zone doesn't necessarily close the skies because they can continue to conduct missile attacks with aircraft not in that region. They can continue to conduct them from the ground, or even from military vessels. So just because you keep Russian aircraft out of a designated area will not stop the butchering that we see going on the ground via Russia attack. So that's just important nuance there that I think it's important for Americans to understand. In terms of things that the Ukrainians are asking for or that they need that we haven't provided yet. You know, it's moving very quickly, but as of last week, I was pushing for we need to provide them secure communications equipment because a lot of the command and control communicating that they're doing is on unsecure lines that the Russians can listen into. So I think we should help them with that. I do fear that we could see a chemical attack, honestly. So I think we need to be providing them the protective suits to survive and operate after a chemical attack. I think we need to help them with anti-jamming, and the list goes on and on. But continuing to provide those Javelin and Stinger missiles, I think, is far and away the most important thing we can do, especially before many of the cities get fully surrounded, and providing this equipment will become much more difficult.
Bradley, we recently saw a Russian missile strike hit a target very close to the Polish border, and Poland, of course, is a NATO ally. If Russia were to strike somewhere over the Polish border, even by accident, what do you think would happen?
I think this could escalate quickly. I mean, very quickly. We don't know what's in the mind of Putin, right? And a lot of people pretend that they know. We don't know. A lot of people, and we don't know what's in the mind of a military commander that launched that missile. So you have to assume malign intent when something like that happens. You don't want to overreact, but we also can't be squishy in terms of making clear that an attack against one is attack against all pursuant to Article 5, the 1949 North Atlantic Treaty, which has made NATO that hard thing for decades that has deterred an invasion against any NATO country. And that's why, really, in the end, Putin has been willing to invade and occupy Georgia and Ukraine, but not other countries. It's because of the deterrent capability of NATO. And that's why I believe we need to focus like a laser beam on reinforcing NATO's eastern flank to make sure that Putin doesn't try to go further.
I want to ask you about humanitarian aid now. What kind of relief are Washington and its allies able to provide under these circumstances?
You know, I think providing humanitarian aid is fundamental, both from a moral and compassionate perspective, but also from a national security perspective. We want to show that not only are we helping Ukraine defend its country against an authoritarian invasion and aggressor, but we also want to show that while Russia's bringing attacks on maternity wards, we're bringing food and aid for the vulnerable. And so, you know, talk is cheap, right? We have to back that up with our actions. So that's why I'm so glad to see the U.S. Agency for International Development playing a leading role. You know, we have over 3 million refugees that have fled Ukraine, with Poland taking in most of those. I think we need to be moving heaven and earth to help those NATO allies deal with this extraordinary refugee flow. We know that Putin in the past, including in Syria, has used refugees as a weapon, if you will, as sick as that is, to try to destabilize Europe, frankly, and spark populist sentiment that weakens and divides the alliance. And I think what he has meant for ill, we should try to turn for good by leading with our hearts and our wallets and doing everything we can to help the poor Ukrainian people who are suffering so much.
Bradley Bowman is Senior Director at the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Bradley, thanks so much. Appreciate your time.
Thank you very much.
Additional support comes from Free Lutheran Bible College in Plymouth, Minnesota, a two-year accredited on-campus program for the study and application of Scripture. Students start here, go anywhere, grounded in God's Word. More at flbc.edu. And from the Ambassadors Impact Network, a group of faith-driven investors who finance private companies led by gospel-advancing entrepreneurs. More at ambassadorsimpact.com.
Coming up next on The World and Everything in It, World Tour, with our reporter in Africa, Onize Ohikere.
We start today with dire warnings of a looming global food crisis. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres told reporters on Monday the war in Ukraine could result in a hurricane of famine.
45 African and least developed countries import at least one-third of their wheat from Ukraine and Russia. 18 of those countries import at least 50%. This includes countries like Burkina Faso, Egypt, Democratic Republic of the Congo, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and Yemen.
Many of those countries already face food shortages due to conflicts closer to home. But Russia's invasion of Ukraine could cut off their largest source of imported wheat, both immediately and next year. Ukrainian farmers usually harvest wheat during the summer, and if the war drags on, it could disrupt their ability to plant next year's crops. Next, we go to Southeast Asia. Residents in Myanmar's commercial capital are using pails, tubs, and buckets to collect water from tanker trucks operated by aid groups. Rolling electricity blackouts in Yangon have cut access to water in many homes. This man says they can use charcoal to cook when the electricity goes out, but they can't live without water. Myanmar has long had trouble with rolling blackouts, especially during the summer months when the demand is high. But the situation got worse after last year's military coup. People stopped paying their bills, and many civil servants walked off the job in protest. Last week, the junta announced even more service disruptions to the country's power supply. It blamed rising gas prices and attacks on infrastructure by anti-coup fighters. Next, to Taiwan. Several hundred members of Taiwan's military reserve participated in training exercises on Monday. Fears of a Chinese invasion have increased in the country since Russia's invasion of Ukraine. In a visit to the training, Taiwan's president cited examples of Ukrainian citizens volunteering to join the fight against Russian forces. She said it showed the important role reserve units would play in defending their own country. This man praised the training and said when the time came, he would know what to do. The training simulates defending a beach near the capital, Taipei. Although Taiwan has functioned as an independent democracy for decades, China still considers it part of its territory. It has threatened to retake the island by force if necessary. And finally, we end today in Europe. Protesters on Monday briefly took over a house in London owned by a Russian oligarch. The mansion at 5 Belgrade Square is one of the city's most expensive properties. The protesters hung a banner from the balcony declaring the property had been liberated. Another banner declared, "You occupy Ukraine, we occupy you."
We are planning to stay until Putin stops the war.
Western sanctions have allowed governments to seize property owned by wealthy Russians with close ties to Vladimir Putin. But these protesters say the process is taking too long. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson called squatting in residential properties illegal, but he said the government is working to identify appropriate uses for properties with owners subject to sanctions. That's it for this week's World Tour. Reporting for World, I'm Onize Ohikere in Abuja, Nigeria.
So I thought I was so clever. I was turning 57. My brother was turning 43. Both of our birthdays are in December. So I said, hey, bro, let's do a combined 100th birthday. And we just had a great time. Well, I have to say, Eric and I have nothing on these siblings. Jerry Bulger turns 101 herself next month. She has a 97-year-old sister, two younger brothers, age 95 and 93, respectively. And the combined age here, did you do the math? 383. That is some kind of modern age record. Speaking with TV station WITI, the elder sister Jerry offered the following advice for living a long, healthy life.
Eat good vegetables and don't try to get too skinny.
Don't try to get too skinny. Check. Got that. Eat good vegetables, though. Working on that. I think it's going to take a lifetime. It's the world and everything in it.
Today is Wednesday, March 16th. You're listening to World Radio, and we're so glad you are. Good morning. I'm Mary Reichard.
And I'm Nick Eicher. Coming next on The World and Everything in It, walking. The Bible is filled with references to walking. Walk in the light, walk humbly with God, keep God's commandments, and walk in His ways. Today, World reporter Jenny Ruff talks with a retired pastor about the Christian walk, both spiritual and physical.
Yeah, this guy really walks the talk.
Craig Clapper wakes up in the morning, leashes up his Australian Shepherd, Little One, and heads to a state park near his home in Indiana where he hikes for 2 hours every day.
I think when I go to that park, God meets me. And I wouldn't give it up for anything today.
Even a freezing, snowy morning in February doesn't derail his plans.
In the state park this time of year, I may not see another soul, just me and my dog.
Clapper is a pastor. He's 71 and says it's much easier to find time for long walks now that he's semi-retired. But he doesn't underestimate the value of a short walk either. I met him for one, followed by a talk in a bookstore. He says God has called his people to walk.
It's amazing. From Genesis, where Adam and Eve walked with God in the cool of the day, to the book of Revelation, where it says, those that are worthy will walk with me in white. Enoch walked with God. Noah walked with God. The Christian life is described as a daily walk.
Clapper credits the book God Walk by Mark Buchanan with helping him better understand how the Christian faith and the physical act of walking correspond.
God told Abraham, walk the land, the length, the width. But then later he said, walk before me and be perfect. So you have a physical walk and you have a spiritual walk. I think Christianity's physical discipline is walking. Jesus probably walked 23,000 miles in all of his journeys. In the Apostle Paul, they have 13,000 recorded miles.
Clapper has found many spiritual benefits to walking. One is his prayer life.
I don't do well sitting and praying. I walk. And there's something about walking and thinking, and you can just pray 1,000 times better.
Plus, being in nature is a daily reminder that God created the world. Walking has also helped him understand his Bible more. Clapper has hiked the Jesus Trail in Israel 3 times.
It's really a cool trail. It says that Jesus left Nazareth and moved to Capernaum, and so they have a trail that follows that route.
About 40 miles.
And then you end up in Capernaum on the Sea of Galilee.
Clapper uses his love of walking for another purpose as well, ministry. In 2013, he spent over 6 months on the Appalachian Trail as a trail chaplain. He hiked the whole footpath, over 2,000 miles, from Georgia to Maine. His job? Offer spiritual support to other hikers.
No one hikes for half a year just to take a hike. They're all working through something, and the opportunity to share is just unbelievable, with no distractions.
He didn't wear a name tag or specific clothing that identified him as a chaplain. No one knew his background as a minister or even his real name.
You have a trail name. My trail name is Hoosier because of being from Indiana.
He didn't preach or hand out tracts. The environment of the woods invited deep conversation.
So you have no distractions. You're around campfires every night. You're out in nature, and you know, all creation screams there's a God. God just brings conversations up, and you have to be a little bold and use the crack in the door. This was very common. I would have people say to me, you know, I'm glad I met you because I was hoping that I would have some kind of a spiritual awakening on this trail. And I have some questions.
Clapper says he learned to never underestimate a brief encounter. Much of Christ's ministry involved brief encounters that were transforming. Among others, Clapper encountered Joe the Hiker, an extremely successful and wealthy man who had 32 patents to his name.
And he told me, I'm out here because I don't need any more money, and I don't know what to do with the rest of my life. And Joe the Hiker accepted Christ on the trail.
Clapper says what he learns from long walks translates to his spiritual walk. For example, Clapper points to Psalm 119. The passage praises God for his word that gives direction in life. It's important to stay on the right path, whether walking a trail or walking with God. And that doesn't always mean easy choices. You may have to go up and over a mountain instead of around it. Yet another lesson, enjoy the journey. Clapper says we too often live in a state of anxiety and worry.
I believe all kinds of people are going to get to heaven and say, could I go down there and do it over again, but do it right, trusting you this time and not worried about it? I think that's how we ought to be thinking of the Christian life. Okay, God, you're going to get me home. Mm-hmm. Okay, now I'm going to relax and trust you and enjoy this journey.
He says enjoying the journey doesn't mean discounting the destination. Walking with the end in sight is also important. One day, we will be finished with our earthly pilgrimage. And that brings me back to Clapper's morning walks in the state park near his home. The park has an old graveyard in it.
I bought a grave for my wife and I in that graveyard. And so probably a couple times a week, I stand on my grave and I just think, okay, what do I want them to say about me? That is a really good thing to do.
Until then, Clapper plans to stay faithful to walking, spiritually and physically, and encouraging others to do the same.
Just get creative. You can do this. You know, start small. And people need to get outside. They need to move. God made you that way. And I think it would amaze people the difference it would make in their lives.
Reporting for World, I'm Jenny Ruff in South Bend, Indiana. You can run.
Today is Wednesday, March 16th. Good morning. This is The World and Everything in It from listener-supported World Radio. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. You've no doubt heard about deconversion, Christians renouncing their faith. Their videos are all over the internet.
Well, yes, they are. Very simple search turned up result after sad result on YouTube. Here's a quick sample.
where did I come from, how I was raised as a Christian, sort of how that developed, and then how eventually, you know, it just stopped working for me. I don't believe it.
How is it possible that someone who built her entire life and identity around her faith just walk away from it all? Never could I have imagined back then that someday I would ever reach a point where I would no longer consider myself to be a follower of Jesus.
I think the biggest change that has happened to me is that I've lost my appetite for certainty. I think Christianity, my struggle with Christianity, for me, a big part of it was I had to keep aligning my thoughts and being certain and kind of redriving my faith and why this was reasonable and being sure about this and knowing exactly what was going to happen when I die and all this stuff. But when I was like, I don't think I can be certain about these things, I lost my appetite to be certain.
Other people have made it a point not to deconstruct their faith, but to scorn the church. But even that really misses the crucial point, as world commentator Janie B. Cheney will explain.
Anne Rice passed away on December 11th at the age of 80. This wildly popular author of paranormal and erotic fiction fell in love with Jesus in 1998 and publicly dedicated her craft to him. It seemed an improbable conversion, but most of her life was spiritual pilgrimage. Returning to the church of her childhood was not the final step, however. On a 2010 Facebook post, she announced, "Today I quit being a Christian. I remain committed to Christ, as always, but not to being Christian or part of Christianity. It's simply impossible for me to belong to this quarrelsome, hostile, disputatious, and deservedly infamous group." Shortly after Anne Rice's death, an author I know posted that she, too, now scorned the name Christian. Instead, she wrote, "I call myself a woman of faith." In the final chapter of Acts, while under house arrest in Rome, the Apostle Paul reached out to the local synagogue leaders, who were eager to respond. They had heard the news about Jesus of Nazareth and his followers, but, quote, "We desire to hear from you, Paul, what your views are, for with regard to this sect, we know that everywhere it is spoken against." But wait, back in the early days in Acts 2, the followers of Jesus were finding favor with all the people. What happened? These synagogue rulers had likely received an earful from the Judaizers, Jewish believers who insisted on keeping Mosaic law. But another reason for Christianity's bad press was probably Christians. We idealize the early church, with reason, but the biblical record is far from spotless. Some Christians were hypocrites, like Ananias and Sapphira. Some were libertines, like the gluttonous Corinthians. Others were legalists, like the Judaizers. Some preached Christ out of selfish ambition, and some made shipwreck of their faith. And the rest, in spite of their failures, took the gospel into all the world and changed it forever. Scorning the church for her checkered past and conflicted present harms the soul in two ways. It makes flawed mortals the arbiters of holiness, and it deprives them of sanctification through love for the unlovely. In his letter to the Ephesians, Paul contends for the church as e pluribus unum, building to his great prayer in chapter 3, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may have the strength to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth and length and height and depth, to know the love of Christ that surpasses knowledge. We can't comprehend the love of Christ individually. There may be a time to leave the local congregation, but never a time to leave the church. I've compared her to an ugly bride stumbling down the aisle toward glorification. That's me, and that's you. Who beautifies her? In his honor, we glory in the name Christian. I'm Janie B. Cheney.
Tomorrow, the historical context of the conflict in Ukraine and how fuel standards for cars actually increase fatalities. That and more tomorrow. I'm Nick Eicher.
And I'm Mary Reichard. The world and everything in it comes to you from World Radio. World's mission is biblically objective journalism that informs, educates, and inspires. The Bible says Jesus Christ is the same yesterday and today and forever. Go now in grace and peace.